Fill the Gap, the official podcast series of the CMT Association, hosted by David Lundgren and Tyler Wood. This monthly podcast will bring veteran market analysts and money managers into conversations that will explore the interviewee's investment philosophy, their process, and decision-making tools. By learning more about their key mentors, early influences, and their long careers in financial services, Fill the Gap will highlight lessons our guests have learned over many decades and multiple market cycles. Join us in conversation with the men and women of Wall Street who discovered, engineered, and refined the discipline of technical market analysis.
Gap is brought to you with support from Optima, a professional charting and data analytics platform. Whether you're a professional analyst, portfolio manager, or trader, Optima provides advanced technical and quantitative software to help you discover financial opportunities. Candidates in the CMT program gain free access to these powerful tools during the course of their study. Learn more at optima.com.
Hello and welcome to Fill the Gap, episode 29, with our very special guest, Craig Johnson, CMT CFA. Joining me today is Dave Lundgren. How you doing, my friend?
As always, Tyler, doing well. You know, I'm just slowly watching this AI bubble percolate.
Isn't it too early to call that a bubble?
I don't think so, but I think the fact that we're identifying it as a bubble probably means it's not a bubble yet.
That's right. That's right. There we go. We recorded with Craig mid-June, on the 12th to be exact, and had just an incredible conversation about his take on global markets, what he's seeing in the charts, and from a technical perspective. Dave, what stood out to you from our conversation with Craig?
Well, to be honest, I've known Craig for years, and I actually forgot about how far back into the history books of technical analysis in the CMT Association in particular. Mm-hmm. That his whole research process reaches. I mean, it's all the way back to Steve Luthold, and I forgot about that. You know, yep. And I've read the book that he sends out every month for years, and I I'm sitting here reading this book, not realizing that it reaches all the way back decades. You know, into the history of the CMT Association. So it was great to hear. But I've always valued Craig's his judgment and his skill set in technicals. He's just very, very systematic, very even keeled, and he just does a great job of listening to the market and the whole process of systematically tracking thousands of stocks and then just letting the market speak to him. And he's just a good interpreter, as opposed to a forecaster. And he's great at it.
You know, that really stood out to me that as part of the global macro team at Piper Sandler, there's not always going to be, you know, full agreement, right? If we all see the chart the exact same way, that's not what makes a market. And Craig had very positive things to say about his colleagues and the fact that they have a different toolkit and they see things differently. But I think it's also a testament to Craig's personality that he's not afraid to step out with his own opinion, even if it is not the view of the fundamental side of the house at Piper. And so far this year, the market has been proving Craig right.
He's had a good contrarian call against a very seasoned, very highly respected macro team. Whoever ends up being right out of this call isn't the point, and they'll be just as respected as they've ever been. I've listened to that team, and they're among my favorite macro strategists on the street. So it's not a us against them thing. It's just, you know, sometimes we'll be right, sometimes I'll be right. But this is what Craig does best. This is when he really shines, when he is willing to put the stake in the ground and make a call, you know. And I actually have a t-shirt in my office. It's S&P 2K, or I think it was the shirt.
That's exactly right. And a Homer Hanke. Minnesota Twins.
That's how convicted he was in his call based on listening to what the market was saying. He made t-shirts about it. And it was, so he's, he's pretty committed in his process, and that's the way it needs to be, you know?
Yes, exactly. When I first joined the MTA, as it was back in the day, Craig was a board member, very actively involved, yeah. Became vice president. I've gotten to travel quite extensively with him for CMT conferences and events. And then he became board president. And like you said, not afraid to make a contrarian call now and again. And I think that stewardship and appreciation of the history coming from Steve Leuthold and others at Piper Sandler, he has deep respect for those who came before him, but also, you know, blazing his own trail. And he certainly brought that to leadership of the organization as well, which is great to see.
Yeah, and you know, from Minnesota, we won't divulge the whole thing here, but from Minnesota, there's a lot of ways you can heat your house. But let's just say you have to heat your house if you live in Minnesota, and if you listen through the whole interview, you'll learn about how Mr. Craig Johnson heats his house.
You know, Dave, he and I graduated from the same high school, and I think some of his hobbies might be melting the ice rinks around Minnesota. Pretty soon, if he's not careful.
Yeah.
Well, just before we get into today's episode, I want to congratulate all of our global CMT candidates. Here in the month of June, there is an intense, rigorous exam cycle. And for all of you who are listening, job well done. Grades will be coming out in early August, but just sitting for the exam. Taking a chance on yourself, investing in your own education, and having the confidence to prove your skills in a very rigorous testing environment is that's worthy of praise in and of itself, regardless of the score. And for all of you who missed the chance to further your career and a chance to earn your own CMT designation, don't worry. Registration just opened for our next exam cycle, which will be held November 30th through December 11th. So you can head to cmtassociation.org right after this episode and get registered for your exams. So, Dave, without any further ado, let's dive into episode 29 of Fill the Gap, the official podcast of the CMT Association, with our good friend Craig Johnson, CMT CFA.
Welcome to Fill the Gap, the official podcast of the CMT Association. This month, Tyler and I are joined in conversation by Craig Johnson, Chief Market Technician and member of the Macro Research Team at Piper Sandler. Craig is a longtime CMT charter holder, and he also has a CFA charter. And Craig has been a model member of the CMT Association over the years, of course, most importantly, serving as a past president. Now, I've known Craig for about 20 years, and I followed his work very closely, and he's never been afraid to have a contrarian call on the market. So I'm really looking forward to catching up with him and getting his latest thoughts on the markets. Craig Johnson, welcome to Fill the Gap.
Thanks, Dave. Thanks, Tyler. It's great to be on the show.
Nice to have a hornet with us.
It is very nice to have another hornet here.
So you've been at Piper Sandler for 28 years. That's quite a run. Maybe for our listeners who don't know you, there's probably very few, but let us know how you got into the business and what got you heading down the path of technicals.
Thanks, Dave. So what got me going in the investment business and technicals and charts was really back in college. I started getting involved with, it used to be the AT&T Stock Challenge when I went to Drake University. And at that point in time, I just thought it was so much fun to be picking stocks for the portfolio. There was also a gentleman there by the name of, Dave, and I'm drawing a blank on his last name, but he's the one that introduced me while I was in school at grad school and undergraduate at Drake University to the William O'Neill Green Book and Blue Book. We had a great time going through and flipping through those books, looking at stocks, looking at charts. I think I spent just hours and hours of time looking through those books, and then started doing some of my own trading while I was in undergraduate and graduate school there at Drake. And believe it or not, Tyler, I actually had a quote machine while I was in the fraternity house.
Old
green screen machines where I could just flip the pages on it. And I was trading stocks. My roommate, Alan Sugar, at the time was trading corns, beans, hogs, and all those things. And we had big whiteboard up in our frat house room, and we were trading and also enjoying the frat house life too.
Very good.
And then I'll just add two into this, Dave, is that after I got done going to grad school, I came back to Minneapolis. I knew that I wanted to do something with technical research. I knew there were not many places in Minneapolis to do this. And so I found out that Piper, Jaffrey, and Hopwood at the time, now Piper Sandler, had a technical research department. It was run by the gentleman of Ed Nikoski. And I called up one of the gentlemen on his team pretty much every day for 6 months saying, hey, this is Craig Johnson. I'd love to talk to you about any positions you might have open. And finally, after about 6 months, he called me back and said, yep, we'll give you a shot. Why don't you come on in? And we started working with Ed Nikoski and the technical research team back in the fall of 1995. And I got to tell you, Dave, my starting salary, I think, was a whopping $24,000 for the year. And I told my dad that I'll probably stick around for 6 months, get some experience. And, well, he reminds me it's now been 28 years that I've been working here at Piper.
Yeah, 28 years and a few pay raises, I assume.
A couple along the way. But, you know, we have to figure out how to trade and make some of our own income along the way, too. So that we do that also.
Craig, I wanted to ask, you had a quote machine, you were trading in grad school. Did any professor ever mention technical analysis in any of your courses in business school or grad school?
Well, at Drake, the answer is really no. I was not taught technical research at Drake. I still a bit of a sore spot with me that they didn't want to teach technical analysis. And a few of the conversations that I had with the professors, they viewed technical research as really voodoo. There was no reason to learn technical analysis because it had to all be about fundamentals and those kind of things. And even when I would pull some of the books, pull some of the material and all these other things, have the conversations with the professors, they didn't really want to talk about it at all, unfortunately. So makes me not a big donor for Drake.
vote with your wallet. I like that.
Yeah. So a lot of folks aren't going to be familiar with Ed Nikoski because he's most well known on the institutional side. And of course, I've been following. What's the name of the book? Is it The War Book?
Well, we have the Informed Investor publication we put out. And we also have the statistical book, which we call the White Book, that has all the numbers and statistics on the market. Some people have also called it The War Plan over the years, Dave.
The War Plan. That's it. Yeah.
Yes. That's just not been a very popular name for a publication, especially if you're traveling internationally. You pull this thing out and it's called The War Plan. Yeah. And it's all full of numbers. And I've had a few experiences going through Heathrow where they go through your bag and they're asking you, sir, what is this war plan that you've got? And what do all these numbers mean? Is this some sort of code? But no, it's just the code and DNA of the market and trend and relative strength.
Talk a little bit about the book, because again, I'm familiar with that book for, gosh, 20 years now. So it was started by Ed Nikoski, or?
Yeah, so The War Plan data, and then ultimately The Informed Investor publication. These all started at Piper, Jaffrey, and Hopwood back in basically the late 70s and early 1980s. At the time, it was led by a gentleman by the name Steve Luthold, who is very familiar with everybody here that's going to be listening to this podcast. Yeah. And he unfortunately just passed away in March. And then at that time, Ed Nikoski was working as an associate, is my understanding, to Steve Luthold. And they had worked together for years. And then when Steve left to go start his own firm, then Ed Nikoski took over to become the senior of the technical project for years. And that is when people just kept refining the War Plan publication or White Book, and then also the Informed Investor publication. And for those that have been to the library at Baruch College, Tyler, you will find some of the original versions of the Informed Investor publication there in the library. But here in my office in Minneapolis, I think I have every copy or a copy of every Informed Investor publication we put out since basically the 1990s. So there's been, we've done 10 of them a year, every year since then. So it's been a longstanding project. And for me, when I took over in 2004, I came into this group, took it over as a senior in 2007. It's just been sort of a labor of love since.
So for all of our listeners, you might be familiar with a technical research analyst that might put out a weekly note, or you might have read some blog posts. When we talk about the informed investor, I'm looking at the May edition. It's 310 pages. And I am the owner, proud owner of a few copies that Craig has bestowed on me over the years. They make a great third base, Craig. I mean, you could hold a door open for eons with these books, right? There's some heft to that.
And you know, to that point, Tyler, there's many times that I've stopped in the New York office and I've found the informed investor used as a doorstop. I quickly pick it up, dust it off, put it back on the shelf where it should be.
Yeah.
And remind them that the informed investor is more than a doorstop. It's a way to make money in the market.
Yeah. All joking aside, this is perhaps the most thorough and thoughtful and comprehensive technical research, certainly that I've seen on the street. And to do that 10 times a year, Craig, that's a mountain of labor. How big is the technical research team now at Piper Sandler?
So, Tyler, it's a labor of love for us to put this book together, but it is also part of the process that we've developed over the years. We've got the Informed Investor publication. We've got our weekly publication. We've got our daily notes that we put out. And then there'll be some quarterly reports and things along the way. But it really forces the team, which is a fairly tight team of individuals. It's myself. It's another gentleman by the name of Scott Smith, who's another fellow CMT. We've got two gentlemen that work for us in Chennai, India. They're also CMTs. So we've been introducing India to CMTs. And then we also have Daniela Martinez, who works on our team as sort of the administration assistant, helping us keep track of marketing, schedules, travel, and all these different pieces. And we are very grateful for all her hard work.
Mm-hmm. Awesome.
Greg, this book has set the bar for like what's excellent in research, certainly technically over the years. And what I've loved about it is that it's always been so, it doesn't, you know, go off into these rabbit holes of technical analysis. It's just really pure trend following, relative strength, momentum, and things like that. Can you talk about a little bit about what the thought process is in terms of what you put into the report and, you know, why do you exclude some things versus what you allow in? And
sure. So Dave, what we always try to do is we try to think about this entire market. And again, when I say market, we're looking at every single stock above a 25 million market cap and a $2 price. So this can be 5,000 stocks that we're pulling into our database every single night. And Dave, as part of the process of what we go through is we take, and again, through this reiterative process of looking at all the charts every single day, every single week, every single month, we will develop kind of a picture of what's happening with the market. Now, in terms of the selection of what we put into the book, we can't show all 406 industry groups that we've got, so we narrow it down. How do we do that? Well, we do that by using our trend and our relative strength tools that we call MACE and also Technigrade. And then Dave, what we do is basically put the entire market into sort of a normal total return relative strength distribution. And we sort of throw out the middle. And every single week we score all of these industry groups that we got, either an overweight, a neutral, an underweight. And for the publication, for the most part, Dave, I sort of throw out the middle. I want to show the overweights. I want to show the underweights, because we know that the place to make money in the institutional world is going to be at the tails of the distribution in terms of the total return relative strength, not necessarily in the hump. And again, if there's other key parts of the market that might be neutral rated, for instance, right now, I look at things like United Healthcare and the HMOs. I'll show them because they're negatively rated. I'll show the semiconductors because they're neutral rated and then getting stronger. You know, those are the kind of things we'll try to do. But we're trying to find stocks and groups in motion, Dave, to highlight. And that might get narrowed down to about 100 to 120 different sort of industry groups. We call them microgroups that we're going to go out and highlight. And then after that, we're going to find the most attractive looking chart to put into that or to highlight from that particular group. So it becomes an actionable research report for people if they're looking through technology, industrials, healthcare, whatever it is. They'll find ideas that they'll find actionable today.
And how would you characterize your approach personally? Is it, because I've known you over the years as definitely being somebody, as you just described, somebody that wants to be on the right side of trend, relative performance, follow the strength, follow the lead of the market. But I've also known you to take some pretty contrarian calls that I would never take because I'm a trend follower. So that, you know, it would seem to me like you're not always a trend follower. Like you, at times you will go against the trend, and it seems like at those really intense sentiment driven moments, you'll go contrary to that kind of thing. So maybe you can talk a little bit about that.
So Dave, you are correct. But the reason we do that is because when we go through and we look at this entire war plan data, what we've discovered over the years is with, you know, great help from some of our former associates like Adam Turnquist, who's now over at LPL Financial and does a great job over there now for them. We miss him, but he added a lot of value to the project and left his mark certainly in a positive way on the project over the years. But the way that we will do that, Dave, is when we go through and we look at our 40-week technique where we measure the number of groups above their 40-week moving average, when we start getting to sort of sub 10% readings in terms of the industry groups and stocks above their 40-week moving average, we know that from history, going all the way back to the 1960s, when we get to those sort of capitulation sort of points, this is where we need to start leaning the other direction. And I know that it's not immediately in sync with trend, but we're at such an outlier level that we have to play contrarian, Dave, at that point in time. And we've gone back through time and we've said, hey, the average length of time that we stay sub 10% could be 8 to 9 weeks. And we know that this is when we want to start leaning into the market. We are trend followers first and foremost, but we also know that there's points in time when you're at these sort of extremes and you have to pay attention to start leaning the other direction. And again, it's worked out well for us over the years. And we continue to really like those spots because they tend to be pretty well fleshed out to the bottom, pretty good washout points. Emotions are running high, as you mentioned, Dave, and it tends to be a strong contrarian call that a lot of people sort of fight you on a little bit. But that fighting that you get from people on this and questioning of it actually is sort of a good sign. That means that nobody's on board with you and market will eventually come back the other way.
What are some of the techniques you use to determine, let's say the market's washed out, everything's really extreme, thereby meaning everything, most things are in a downtrend. What are some of the techniques you use to determine which stocks to buy if you can't use trend following as your guide because everything's in a downtrend? What do you lean on?
So what I'm going to lean on is I'm going to lean back on price first and foremost, something I've learned from Ralph Acampora over the years, right? Price is fact at the end of the day. And if I see stocks that have pulled back to big, long-term identifiable support on a weekly or monthly basis, these are going to be areas that where I'm going to be very interested in picking up some of those ideas. I'll also be looking through some of the sectors. One of the things that you've taught me over the years too, Dave, is what's the leadership of the market and look for those turns that are happening out there. And I'll be looking for those things that are really starting to bounce the hardest. And the question is it bounce? Is it sustainable? Is it not sustainable? But that's what I'll be looking for in those sort of turning points. And again, coming back to price though for that big identifiable support.
Yeah.
And of course, in the informed investor, you've got sentiment analysis. You're looking at the VIX. You're looking at seasonality and cycles. Are they driving action in terms of your recommendations, or is that helping give context and more of a narrative to what you're seeing in the marketplace?
So, Tyler, seasonality and VIX and other things VIX is going to help me with sentiment in the market for sure, is where that's going to help me along with some of the AAII numbers and some of those other pieces. I would also say that as I look through the various studies and other parts that we put into the informed investor, that's where I'm getting context and perspective from history. Mm-hmm. I've often said that history may not repeat, but if it does rhyme, then we know that this is a potential outcome that we could see. And we will do lots of those different kinds of studies. I've learned a lot of those studies from folks like Sam Stovall over the years that we stay in touch with, thinking about what it means when you've got a 20% advance coming off of major market bottoms and what's the probability that that will continue versus fail. All those things sort of blend together for us context with trend that you're talking about, Dave, with the relative strength where we need to ultimately focus, the emotion, the sentiment with the AAII, the VIX indicators, all those things come together. We try to shut out a lot of extra outside news and try to just focus on these sets of tools, trend, and sentiment to really help drive us into the right direction of where we need to be. It can be challenging when you've got a lot of smart people yelling at you like, you're wrong, you're wrong, you're wrong. and the world's going to fall apart. And you keep looking at the data and you look at, like we had last October, Dave, and you and I talked about this at dinner a few months ago. You had this big sort of momentum washout. It's very noteworthy and things you got to pay attention to. And it's proving out to be correct. And right now, very, very simple things like the trend changes in the major popular averages are quite constructive.
More recently, you've kind of transitioned with your new role at Piper Sandler. So you're still the chief market technician there, but you're also a member of the macro strategy team. And that must be a pretty stressful conversation or meeting that you guys might have from week to week, because most macro strategists are seeing the world pretty grimly, particularly over the next few months with recession and inflation and God knows what else they're pointing to. But how does your analysis fit into that team, and how do you manage those conversations that can be pretty sensitive?
Well, first and foremost, I'm very happy to be part of the macro team here at, you know, Piper Sandler. Number one, with Nancy and Michael Kantowicz coming on board, Danny Kirsch on the options side, Benson Durham on the policy side of things, and others, it's been great to join this team. They provide a whole nother set of perspectives for me to be thinking about with markets. Yes, we look at different tools, but, you know, Nancy and Michael, they're true professionals, and we can agree to disagree on things. And again, a friendly way, have these debates back and forth and have these conversations. The beautiful thing at Piper, all the way down from Chad Abraham down, who runs the firm, is it's okay to have differing views and perspectives. And in fact, they encourage that. There isn't a single house view. Mm-hmm. And I think everybody embraces that and brings that to the table as we have these sort of conversations about the market. How do I handle things? I just come back with statistics and stats and point out charts. I'll pull out pages and from the informed investor and say, hey, I hear your negative sentiment on housing, but look at the chart of this. Here's a long-term chart going all the way back to the 1960s. We're breaking out and making relative strength new highs. I hear you, but the charts are saying something different. Where could we potentially be thinking about things differently? So it becomes, Dave, kind of a conversation starter and sort of an enhancer to be pulling these pages out of the book. It's almost like you're just kind of laying the cards out here and you say, hey, look at this on the economy. You think this, look at that chart. And we'll kind of just have this sort of debate back and forth. And again, I'm very happy to work with the team. They've taken the readership of the technical product here at Piper over tenfold what it was before they came.
Oh, fantastic.
So It's been very good for technical analysis. It's been very good for Piper. And it's been very good to help us get the technical message out to even more people that perhaps hadn't been looking at the charts before that are now doing so. So not only have they been terrific, but the sales folks have been great along the way in terms of selling and redistributing and getting this out in front of people. It's been a great experience all the way along. And the conversations, while it gets competitive at points in time, we're all competitive people. But at the end of the day, as Ralph Acapora would say, price is fact.
Yeah. Competitive is fine. Respectful is the most important thing. And it's shared 100%. Views. And, you know, it's really interesting the what you just highlighted in terms of the value of technicals. I mean, there are many levels to the value of technicals. But for the folks who are not technically oriented, what I've always found to be the greatest value of introducing technicals into a conversation in a group that's not otherwise technically aware is that it sharpens the pencil and sharpens the focus on the disconnects between what the market's saying and what everybody else in the room is saying. And as I always like to say, the market's the best fundamental analyst on the planet. And your job as a technician is to just listen to the best fundamental analyst on the planet. And if you can highlight those clear and obvious discrepancies between what the conversation is in the room relative to what the market's trying to tell you, that's one of the greatest values. So, like, you know, for any non-technician or technically oriented investor who might be listening, I mean, that's just one of the great values of getting CMTs on your team, because they literally drive the most critical conversations. It's the gap, right, Tyler? It's the gap between the fundamentals and technicals, and that's what we're trying to close that gap. And, you know, Craig, you're a warrior in that effort. So, this is great examples of it.
So being in Minnesota, incredible agricultural and commodities driven region of the country, do you find yourself influenced at all or paying attention to intermarket relationships? And how does that play out with the macro team? Do you have folks who are specializing in on the currency markets or on some of these inflation driving commodities?
Well, Tyler, first and foremost, I think of Minnesota as sort of the haven of technical sort of research. Yeah. We've got myself here. We've got Ralph Ockampora is here. We had Steve Luthold here. We've had a number of great technicians coming out of Minneapolis. So I think what Minneapolis provides us is sort of we're outside of sort of potentially groupthink that you might get pulled into, you know, in the New York area where everybody's like saying so-and-so has done this, so-and-so has done that. We're kind of just one step removed from some of that. So we can sort of just focus a little bit more clearly on the trends and the relative strength. And in terms of being in Minneapolis, being a obviously lots of agriculture here between farming, between dairy and all the other pieces, you know, Tyler, we do bring some of that into our work. And we do have sections in our book that'll have commodities, currencies, foreign markets. We'll look at all these different things. And it's fascinating for me right now hearing about this entire discussion about inflation and watching corn prices breaking down and wheat prices breaking down and seeing these things. And it's often been said to me by some pretty smart people that America runs on two things, cheap food and cheap fuel. And it seems like that's what's happening at this point in time. So we try to pull all these things together. And then in terms of the intermarket relations, those are very, very important. And I think anybody that hasn't read John Murphy's book on intermarket analysis, if you haven't read it, you absolutely need to read it. It is the best book that I've ever read on it. And it's been probably one of the most influential books for myself to think about these relations. And then bringing this back to the team, to what your question was, yes, I have these intermarket discussions with the macro team on a regular basis. And we'll look at some of the relationships and correlations between these various pieces and point these things out, which I think they find interesting. But again, they've got their own tools and processes to help them make decisions. And again, we'll try to complement what they're doing, point these various pieces out. But at the end of the day, we can have multiple opinions and multiple viewpoints. And that is ultimately a good thing.
Absolutely. Thanks, Craig.
Do you know anything about crypto? Have you ever heard of it? Do you?
How do you heat your house, Craig?
Yes. For everyone that's going to be listening to this podcast, yes, I've been mucking around with cryptocurrencies with my eldest son probably since about 2016, 2017. We've been doing that. And yes, we've heated the house over the years using Litecoin miners more recently.
That's not a joke, by the way. He really means that. He's heated his house. Tell the story about the utility
the gas company.
repair guy that showed up at your door saying, "What's wrong with your heat that we're not getting any bills from you?"
Yeah. So it's a good story, Dave. So years ago, this is probably, I think, 2018, 2019 timeframe, when we first started getting the servers up and running in the house. Before I even get to that, Dave, let me just say this. When I first fired up our first Bitcoin server back in 2016, 2017, this thing started up and I could hear this thing winding up and I could hear from my wife upstairs, "No and hell no are you running those things in the house," because they are pretty loud when you get them up and running. So needless to say, that went down the road of figuring out how to soundproof part of my utility room. But as we grew over the years in terms of the number of servers we put in, the electrical bills started going up, the heat started rising inside of the house, and you are right that we weren't using any natural gas, and the gas company came knocking on the door one time, and they're like, it's like 20 below zero and the gas meter isn't running. Can we come in and see what's going on?" And I said, "Yeah, come on in. Not a problem." And I showed them what I was doing and they're like, "Okay, that's a good idea. Repurpose the heat from these servers, put it back into the cold air, return on the furnace and heat the house. Just let the boiler motor run. Great utilization. I kind of think I'm green, but perhaps not." But at the end of the day, we've had that happen. And then, Dave, we've also had the sheriff's department over a few times because we've lit up a few screens on their end from heat signatures and other things on the house. And it's probably not really normal to have the windows open when I was trying to figure out our heat problem in the middle of winter for a few years either. Never needed to close the windows. You could just leave them open and walk around in shorts in the house. So needless to say, my wife has been patient with this sort of hobby my son and I have had.
Yeah, I just want to restate it. I'm sure people have picked up on this, but we're talking about Minnesota here. We're not talking about Florida.
We are talking about 20, 30 below zero temperatures and sometimes colder. And yes, you can use these things to certainly heat the house. Now, the opposite, Dave, is a little bit of a problem in the summer. Because we got to get rid of the heat. You can't just throw it out of the house. And you can't just throw all the hot air out of the house. Because what I've learned over the time is you put your house into a negative deficit. And when you do that, you can't like open doors. You can't do other things when you suck all the air out of the house. So you got to be cognizant of what you're doing in terms of pressures in the house too. Because that can also lead to mold or lead to other things like that. I did not have any issues with those. Anybody wants to buy my house in the future. But what I will say, though, is we did have to put in a separate air conditioning unit just to mine, just to cool the miners that we have in the house. And one of the funniest or actually coldest days of the year back in 2018 or 2019, I had the air conditioning and heating and cooling people over installing a 64,000 BTU air conditioner, and we're installing it in February when it's 20 below zero. And these guys are coming to my house and they're like, what do you need air conditioning for? It's 20 below zero. Just open the windows. I'm like, dude, the windows are already open. We need some more cooling. So needless to say, it's been a learning experience, and it's been a great sort of father-son project over the years, too, that we've had a lot of fun with.
Yeah.
All the engineering that you don't think about in in cryptocurrency mining. That's fantastic.
You got to think about that, and then you also have to think about taxes. You have to think about trading. You have to think about position management and all these other things and how you're going to depreciate your servers and all the other stuff that a lot of people don't think about. But if you put it all together, is it profitable? It is profitable. You just need to put all the pieces together, and it's not going to be just a quick plug it in, set it up, let it run, and you're done. There's more, a lot more to it than that. But it's been a good learning experience and certainly a lot of fun over the years.
Awesome.
So let's maybe transition a bit to your view on the markets here. I know you have had a, which no longer, well, I guess it could still be a contrarian call because still a lot of people, particularly in the macro space, don't believe in the bull market. But we spoke several months ago, you were pretty bullish on the market based on all those contrarian things that you had highlighted at the time. Things seem to be kind of turning the corner, kind of coming to your view. Maybe give us an update. What do you like about the market? Anything that worries you, concerns you, et cetera?
Yeah, so I guess from the kind of big picture perspective, and I'll kind of drill into this, it seems to me that the momentum low was made in October. And since then, we've been making on a very simple perspective, a sort of a series of higher highs and higher lows is what we've been starting to make. You can see that with the S&P 500. And the evidence has just been sort of building is what we've been observing. We first started seeing multiple pushes up to the downtrend resistance line, Dave, off of the January 22 highs. And then we finally got through that. And we started reversing downtrends on the S&P, the Dow, the NASDAQ, the Russell. All those pieces started reversing. Then we started seeing golden crossovers of 50-day moving averages back above 200-day moving averages. And again, people are still continuing to fight that the trend has changed and reversed from a downtrend to an uptrend in the broader market. Sentiment along the way has remained predominantly negative. And then as of this week, we've now got sort of the start of potentially a bull market. Your definition has been a 20% advance off of a low is considered to be a bull market. You're up over 30 for the NASDAQ at this point in time. And there's just still tons of people that are like, this market can't work. It's going to crash. And yet the trends have changed. And people just are ignoring the fact that price and trend has changed. And from my perspective, one of the more interesting pieces that I had put out just in the last couple of weeks in the big old informed investor book that you've got there, Tyler, is we went back and we looked at how often do we see the NASDAQ composite outpace the Dow by at least 10% in any given quarter. And when we went back and did that analysis, we found that since the 1970s, you know, there's only been about a dozen times that you've seen the NASDAQ composite outpaced the Dow by at least 10%. And what's fascinating to me is if I look at all those periods where that has happened after at least a 10 to 20% decline in the market. We've also started to see the S&P move back above its simple 40-week moving average. And we've seen that happen pretty much in each one of those instances. And the other interesting thing about that too is, and I didn't realize this until after I got done with this analysis, I was on my Bloomberg and I just said, how does this align with recessions? So I flipped on the little recession tool and I was like, wow, this really only happens at the very end of recessions. Pretty much five out of the last five recessions we've seen, at the very end, the NASDAQ has outperformed the Dow by at least 10% in five of the last five end of recession windows. And then, Dave, I took it one step further, which we like to do is look at forward returns. And when I look at forward returns 6 months later from having that performance, the NASDAQ outpacing the Dow by at least 10%, you're higher on average 7.03%. And your median or your positivity rate is 69%. So you got pretty good odds that this is going to continue to play out in here. And I love taking all these sort of studies and pieces and putting it together. And it's laying out for us the path. And for us, the path of least resistance continues to be higher for this market. And then one other thing, if I could throw out there.
Of course, Dan.
I think it's great to look at positioning data. So the commitment to traders report, look where people are positioned. And in the commitment to traders report, we were at some of the most negative positions on the S&P 500 E-minis that we've been at since periods like June of 2020, October of 2015, October of 2011. These were all periods where you had huge negative net positions with the E-mini futures. And I would just point out, 6 months later after that, you're higher 7.5% of the time with a 75% probability. So again, putting all these things together, you start building that mosaic and framework telling us that this market is going to continue to keep working. Mm-hmm. And that's sort of what we've been talking about. And then we've also had other studies we've done where you, in the first quarter of a new year, you don't trade back below the December prior December low. When that has happened, you've got really nice probabilities and setups for the full year return. So again, all these things together just continue to keep building, be more evidence of a building on top of the mosaic of the evidence of why this market's going to go up, combined with trend, combined with relative strength, and combined together with what you're seeing with some of the dollar interest rates and all the other pieces. It's all coming together nicely. Sentiment, nobody believes.
And the it strikes me, given everything you just said, that your number one sector is probably technology.
Yes, with our tools. Again, we talked about earlier in this podcast that we put everything into a normal distribution. We do the same thing with our ratings too, and that's a great question. So right now we're overweight technology, we're overweight industrials, and we're overweight healthcare, and we've been underweight staples, underweight utilities, and we continue to think that the remaining sector to be underweight would be energy at this point in time. It started to roll over. We had played the energy trade for 82 weeks, and just recently we downgraded it in May as we're starting to see energy beginning to really roll over. So again, if we play that sort of barbell, Dave, as you've seen us talk about, and Tyler, you've seen us talk about for years, if you can get two out of the three sector calls right in a given year, you know that you're going to outperform, or the differential between your underweights and your overweights, excuse me, is somewhere between 20 and 30% in every given year. That is the helpful and usefulness of total return relative strength at a sector level that can give you an advantage where other investors that are trying to just look at the individual equities are going to be missing. We want to get that sector call right. We then want to get the industry group call right. And then we'll think about the individual stock from there.
How do you consider sector calls when, like, energy, pretty much every energy stock trades the same? So it's easy to say the energy sector is an underweight. But when you get into consumer, industrials, tech. I mean, there are so many different things going on in each side of those, inside of each of those sectors, that it's not really a, like when tech was really bad, if not too long ago, semiconductors were on fire. So it was, if you were underweight tech, what you should have been is basically overweight semis and underweight everything else, until just recently where software is catching a bit as well. So how do you differentiate between those two things?
I differentiate them by doing this. First and foremost, I got to stick to the discipline of the three overweights and three underweights, Dave. So there'll be some sector changes that we'll make along the way. But again, we've got 406 industry groups inside of these 12 sectors. So I can then drill down into saying, yeah, maybe technology is a neutral at this point in time, but I can see from the total return relative strength work that semiconductors are standing out, just like I would be seeing that in energy, that it was kind of the large cap names that were sort of holding up there toward the end. And now they've started to sort of roll over too. So again, by having all these detailed groups, Dave, I can then drill down from the sector level down to those industry groups to differentiate, but still maintain what the overall sector rating ultimately is. And to that point, when we do construct our book, I take that into consideration. If I'm overweight a sector, it's really easy for me to find multiple industry groups to call out that are positive. But if I'm neutral a particular sector, I'm calling that out. If I do that, I will then have a balanced approach inside of that group with maybe four positives, four negatives, and I'll keep that sort of balanced approach, because I do believe there's always something to buy somewhere. And that's the beautiful part about the total return relative strength work that we do. And again, that's how we find it ultimately helpful and useful for institutions.
So historically, we've often seen the leadership during the bear market follow through as the new leadership in the next bull phase. Were you surprised to see kind of the darlings of the COVID crash, raging bull, come back as leadership again, mega cap tech names? And I guess the corollary to that is the one piece of evidence that, you know, was really damning to having an early bullish call was just the narrow leadership. We're obviously started to see breadth improvements now, but did that give you pause to see technology names and large cap growth take the lead again in this new emerging bull?
One of the best known technical rules out there is the rule of alternation that Louise Yamada has talked about. And I had a great time having this conversation with her at the CMT symposium that just took place in New York. And thank you, Tyler, for helping put that on. But it gave me an opportunity to sort of take some of these questions that I had for Louise, have the discussion with her. And sort of what I've realized is, if I draw the uptrend support line off of the right shoulder low of the 08-09 bottom, we really never violated that. So if you're going to have a true change of trend, you would then definitely say the rule of alternation would come into play. But we never broke that uptrend. So could we say that the bull market really, the secular bull market really ended? Probably not from that vantage point. And then in terms of the narrow leadership in this market, that is where I got to the question of, why is the NASDAQ so outperforming the Dow? And that's where that narrow leadership sort of came into play. But as I've explained to a lot of institutions, we're looking around as technicians to say, what is the new leadership of this market? And when you start observing what's working, what's not working, it just sort of told us that we're having a resurrection of the FANG stocks again. And that's exactly what we started to see happen. And now, because we have the war plan, because we have all 5,000 stocks that we're looking at, we're starting to see the breadth of this market improving. New highs are beginning to expand. The number of groups that are trending and uptrends is improving, and the number of groups back above their 40 week. Was I surprised by the narrow leadership? It kind of just is what it is. We as technicians are humble observers of the market. And again, I wouldn't draw conclusions too quickly like some have that, because the market leadership is narrow, that this is going to roll over. Let's examine what that narrow leadership was. And in fact, we called out in our publication the fact that Microsoft, Apple, NVIDIA, Meta, and Amazon represented about 40% of the weight of the triple Qs.
Yeah.
And if you looked at those charts individually, you would say none of those are broken. You come to the very basic conclusion that the path of least resistance on a relative and absolute basis for those stocks is higher. And that's a big part of the market. So you sort of got to give it the benefit of the doubt and be like, yeah, this is going to work its way higher. And then, Tyler, pair those that thought together with ratio charts, looking at large versus small, growth versus value. And you can start to see some of the inflection points of the change back towards small mid-cap stocks. And that is indeed starting to play out.
Particularly in those small cap growth names.
Absolutely. And so the question I get from everybody right now, Dave, is what's going to lead for the remainder part of the year? And can these large cap stocks continue to keep working? I wouldn't be surprised if these large cap stocks just sort of went sideways, consolidated here for a while. Because again, from the conversations that I have with a lot of institutions, they're like, we love NVIDIA, but I'm at my mandate waiting. I can't own any more of this. So they're writing calls against it. And so money's coming out of that particular stock because I can't own any more of it. By definition, the market has to broaden out. And I think that's exactly what you're starting to see happen at this point in time with that money coming out. And then again, you can see the confirmation of it on the ratio charts or a base 100 chart looking at the small, mid, and large S&P.
So I know you like to take contrarian perspectives, particularly when, you know, bear markets are underway and things have gotten extreme. Are you also willing, once the bull market has started, are you also willing to take contrarian bets there and say, like, for instance, banks have been really pounded, we're in a bull market, I'm going to buy banks? Or do you, once the bull market's underway, you just go with what the leadership is?
I just want to kind of go with what the leadership is once the bull market's kind of gotten started, Dave. And, you know, if there's something that does worry me, it's the banks have not participated. I've got, you know, memories going back to 2007, where we started seeing the financials not engage with the rest of the market. And so that's been sort of one of the worrisome points. I would say the fundamental folks haven't brought this up enough. It does remain as a concern for me that they're not participating. But I do recognize that this is different than what we had in 2007 and 8. That was a credit problem back then. And I could see when I go through and look at the BAA spreads and those kind of things, they're not widening out the way that you did back in 2007, 8 period of time. Right now, this is a liquidity problem. And the liquidity problem kind of got quickly resolved by the Fed. They kind of broke the toy. They kind of fixed the toy from my perspective, saying, hey, we'll take in all the paper that you need to sell dollar for dollar, and we'll put that facility in place for the next year. And it basically sort of fixed the toy pretty quickly from a liquidity perspective that was starting to become a cascading problem. So to answer your question, Dave, I'm going to try to let the trends play their way out. I do think your financials are going to play some catch up. I'm starting to look at things like the KRE and some of these bank stocks. They're trying to turn. They're trying to move up. But would I rather buy that, or would I rather buy a HubSpot that's already working and trending in a much better and stronger way? The answer is, for the model portfolio that we run, which now does have a structured note behind it, SOTOPUS, S-O-T-O-P-U-S, I have to have something in every single sector, Dave. So I will have exposure out there with a little bit of financials. Again, I'm market weight, so I'll be market weight to that, but I'll have more technology exposure.
So when you're looking at financials, which is a neutral rating in this month's Informed Investor, do you do the same relative strength work within those industry subgroups? Like, would you be overweight the insurance brokerage side and underweight some of the regional banks, at least right now, based on relative strength leadership?
Yeah, absolutely, Tyler. And that's exactly what we'll do. It's the exact sort of same process. We'll rinse and repeat. So we don't own a lot of banks. We haven't owned a lot of banks in a while. We've owned things like credit cards. We've owned some of the insurance companies. We've owned some of the investment banks like Goldman. We've stayed up cap, take that into consideration. And we've also owned things like market makers and electronic traders like Tradeweb and those kind of names. So yeah, we'll absolutely, even though we may be neutral to the sector, our goal is to always try to make money. So we'll definitely be skewing toward the best relative performing and trending groups in a sector that may be neutral rated. Just like the same, we'll do the same for underweight rated sectors too. There's just, again, fewer options, and we'll be underweight the particular sector itself too.
So then just to step back 1 second to the index level, because we're getting deeper into the composition. 46.25 is sort of the year-end target. Everybody would like us to go in a straight line to that number and not have any bumps along the way. When you issue sort of a longer dated price target, there's always going to be some chop. And I think in some earlier publications, you were looking for perhaps a drop, seasonally speaking, or a 5% retracement on this bull market. What are you seeing right now in terms of that breadth expansion and some rotation that might maybe change your opinion to something more range bound and sideways rather than a sharper correction?
Yeah, I mean, you're right. All investors want a straight line sort of move in the market. And we all know, and everybody on the podcast here knows, that the world does not work that way. Right. What we laid out originally, Tyler, for the full year of 2023 is a little play on Dr. Seuss. We talked about a hop, a drop, and a pop. And with that sort of scenario, again, people look at me like, Craig, and you know, Dave, you said this to me before over the years. Okay, we're supposed to observe what's happening today. Don't forecast looking going forward. But in the institutional world and on the sell side, they want a prediction from us, is what they ultimately want. And so what I'll do is I'll step back. And when I put together the hop, a drop, and a pop for 2023, what I was looking at was, A, what does my year-end price objective look like based upon my point and figure price target model that I've got? And then what events are coming up into the year that could sort of fluctuate and lead to that volatility? And so from my perspective, I thought the hop would have probably ended in March, and it continues to keep hopping at this point in time, shall we say. I did adjust my drop scenario from what was originally something along a 10% sort of drop scenario to one that's now about 5%. In the most recent May Informed Investor publication. And I also sort of titled it more of a drop slash chop phase, because I do think that this market's going to move up. Maybe you can have to consolidate before you go on higher. But I do think that the pop phase is still playing out. And what I think will ultimately happen is, if the Fed does pause, or when the Fed is ultimately done, we know that from your last hike to your first cut from the Federal Reserve, that if you plot those charts out, which again, I love charting out anything I can ultimately chart out, we know that you're 12.93% higher on average. And again, the beautiful part about the CMT Association is you meet a lot of great people. This wasn't my original idea that I put in here. I happened to gotten to know Sam Stovall over the years, and this was a idea he and I have talked about on a regular basis, and it ties together very nicely with all these other pieces. So the association is great for networking and meeting people, and I've met a lot of great people that I'm very thankful to have met over the years.
Awesome. Well said.
One of the conversations I've had, particularly if you're bullish when the market is quote unquote expensive, over the years that I've had with institutional colleagues, as I'm trying to convey to them a bullish stance, is that they just really push back hard on valuation. So I'd be curious to know how you handle that situation. How do you coach institutional investors through this conversation about valuation?
In terms of trying to go through the valuation conversation with them, it's a harder conversation to ultimately have, because they will end up sort of talking themselves out of the market when they should probably stay in the market. And so what I try to coach them is, yeah, you can be concerned about valuation, but this market may continue to keep going higher, whether we like it or not. So we're better off putting a trend line below this, or we're better off putting some moving averages into the discussion here. And Let the stock work until you break one of these trend lines or break one of these, you know, moving averages. Ultimately, is how I try to coach him through it. Even using tools like RSI, I would say, don't get too overly carried away, because some of your best momentum and some of your best moves happen when your RSI is north of 70. And it's not until you break back below that 70 level that you would ultimately want to sort of take some of the money off the table. So I think that's how I would coach him. And I have coached him over the years on these kind of things, Dave. And also, it doesn't hurt to take some profits if you're super nervous on it. If its position size is getting to be uncomfortably large, there's more factors than just trend that come into play with these institutions. And again, like I said earlier with NVIDIA, if they're at their mandate, they can't add anymore, you might as well trim some if you're uncomfortable with it and redeploy it elsewhere. So price will come into play, but also the positioning and portfolio positioning has got to be a part of the discussion too, Dave.
Yeah. I'm curious if you have any view or if you've been asked or you've had conversations about whether or not AI is a bubble, what you're finding in that space technically, is that something you'd be overweight? And then just can you couch that conversation in the view of whether or not you think it's a bubble or not?
Sure. I'll be straightforward. I don't think that AI is a bubble yet. AI has the potential to become a bubble, just like the internet became a bubble. And if you think back why this became a bubble, so just quick step back in history. When I started at Piper in 1995, I was like the coolest guy in research because they let me have a dial-up modem at work. Okay. This is like a 28 baud dial-up modem. And I'm showing them like, look at all these things you can do on the internet. And they thought that I was crazy. And at one point in time, I had a sunglass store on the internet with my brother called EJ Sunglasses, which he closed last year after I gave it to him because I didn't think he was doing things the right way. But that's another discussion for another day. but at the end of the day, what I will say is I think that what drove the bubble for the .com was there was a huge demand for internet-related things to happen. The bankers brought a ton of product to market, and it came all too quickly. We haven't even started to see any IPOs related to AI at this point in time. There's a ton of venture dollar, the venture capital, where there's tons of projects and those things will eventually need to come public. But it's going to take, Dave, I think, higher interest rates before it becomes, from a capital perspective, better to go public than it is to borrow money from the banks. And I think that cycle is still yet to come in front of us. So I don't think the ingredients are the same as a bubble at this point in time. Some people have been calling NVIDIA a bubble at this point in time, and it's time to take money off the table. And I'm kind of like, they're kind of like the picks, the axes, and the shovels of what you need to do a lot of this AI stuff. And I'll just make the observation that there's only been 30 times since NVIDIA came public where you had greater than a single day return, greater than 15%. And if you look back 6 months later to a year later, you were higher basically 90% of the time with a return close to 48%. So you're not there yet calling NVIDIA a bubble. And for the entire group, you're not there. I've seen a bubble, and the bubble was the internet. And this is not even close to where that is. It's got the potential to be a bubble, but it's also got the potential to significantly drive productivity in the economy. For those listening on the podcast, I have started to use some Python programming using an API in the ChatGPT. And I can tell you, my code development of writing Python has been sped up tremendously by using ChatGPT. It's an AI. Those things are absolutely terrific. But the bubble's not here yet.
Long way to go. One of the things I point to when people ask me if it's a bubble is, you know, when you have a bubble, it's basically an acceleration of returns over a 6 to 12 month period into meaningful new record high territory. And if you look at an example of an AI ETF would be BOTS, B-O-T-Z, and it's not even at a 52 week high yet.
Yeah.
That's not a bubble.
It's not a bubble. And I also look at what they have inside of some of these ETFs, and I'm kind of like, yeah, there's really not enough product here yet at this point in time. Not enough companies, true companies doing AI, have come public yet. But I think that is on the come. And I think what we should all be watching for, anybody listening to the podcast, is keep track of just how many of these AI related companies come public in the coming months and coming quarters, because I think it's going to be quite a few.
Yeah.
I wonder what the correlation is between those calling for a bubble in AI and those who got burned on their SPAC investments a couple years ago, right? There's some recency bias at play with a lot of these naysayers, right?
I would also just point out that a lot of the macro people that are negative on the market are also calling out AI as a speculative bubble too. Mm-hmm. Very similar. But I agree with you, Tyler. It can be some of the SPACs along the way too.
So in the gold rush to AI, we've got to think about NVIDIA and others as the picks, axes, and shovels that help people get there.
And that, Craig, you, and that And that, yeah. Just let me add one more thing in, Tyler, if I could. That is exactly what happened back in the internet days, is you needed the infrastructure built so that you had all of the on-ramps onto the internet. You had the backbone put in place. You had the storage. You had all the other things. If you think about AI, you need a ton of processing power. You need a ton of memory. You need very low latency networks. You need all those pieces to come into play. And it's just further driving that picks, axes, and shovels sort of phenomena again. But those are the early stages of ultimately a change. And then if I could add one other thing, people keep saying that AI is potentially going to be dangerous. It's going to be a problem. It's going to be these kind of things. I think it's just an evolution of how productive we can ultimately be. I think it's definitely going to drive higher productivity. And I think some of the jobs are going to be impacted right away. I mean, no question, coding, programming, all these things. I mean, I could literally go into ChatGPT and say, hey, I need a Python script to copy files from location A to location B. Write that for me. And it'll basically spit it out for you in a couple of minutes and you can tweak it and you're done. Service jobs, clearly. I've had one gentleman in Geneva, Switzerland say to me that I'm a dinosaur and technical analysis is going to be replaced by AI. And I just kind of pulled out for him the Top Gun line that may be true, Mav, but not today. And that's kind of how I think about the world of technical analysis and AI.
Total opinion piece here, but it does seem like the accounting industry might be more readily disrupted by repetitive tasks that can be easily replicated by AI rather than the interpretive work that technical analysts need to do. Craig, you made an offhand comment about a higher interest rate environment that might generate a frothier IPO market when it becomes more advantageous to go public than to debt finance any of these projects. We haven't really talked about the major secular inflection on, you know, like a quarterly chart of the TNX. We can see that, you know, I basically came into the world at the top of the market, and it's been down for about 41 years until recently. We've had this sideways consolidation since the highs in October last year on something like the TNX. Are you looking for it to break above that downward sloping trend channel? And if so, what do you think the implications are for the equity markets? But maybe more specifically, what do you think the implications are for the crypto markets?
Okay, so let's address the bonds first. We'll go to equities. We'll hit up cryptos. So ultimately, I think that the secular change, and again, secular, long-term, 40-year-plus downtrend reversal in 10-year bond yields, is the single most significant chart that any technician is going to see probably in our career. And Dave, I think you got a long career still ahead of you. So I just want to let you know.
Tell us how you really feel, Craig. The most important chart.
You got a long career. It's the most important chart. And what I would say is we all know that if you study price action of the market, that once you reverse a long-term secular trend, you surge through it, and then you usually spend time backing and filling. And I suspect that you could see through the course of this year, Tyler, backing and filling back toward 3, 3.25 from where we are right now. And that would not surprise me at all to see that sort of short-term backing and filling. Could there be a point in time where ultimately sort of the 10-year bond yield just goes sideways for a while? I think the answer to that is yes. We saw that coming out of World War II when you had the major sort of spinning down or unwinding of the war footing and production and all those kind of things that took place. You started seeing interest rates moving up, but eventually they got sort of capped and stuck in a range for about 10 years. Would not be surprised to see that happen, given the fact we've got $32, $33 trillion of debt sitting out there. Having rates going up too quickly would be very negative. And I think everybody in Washington, Republicans and Democrats, are well aware of that happening. And hence they got the debt ceiling issues, I think, squared away pretty quickly because they do not need a default and have higher interest rates. Now, play that into the equity market. I do think that coming off of these zero sort of 10-year bond yield type rates, and by the way, just years and years, it was a couple years ago, you had Austria come out and issue, you know, 100-year bonds. I mean, they're my heroes. Like, they absolutely nailed that completely perfectly. And now they put the country in very good financial footing for 100-plus years with how much they issued. I was surprised how much people snapped that up. But be that as it is. Now, in terms of equities, rates going higher, moving up in here a little bit, I think that will ultimately lead to people changing how they finance things. There'll be more banking that's going to come into play. There'll be more initial and IPO offerings that take place. I think that'll ultimately be good for Wall Street across the board. I think that'll also mean that with some higher inflation out there, I think equities will probably be a pretty decent place ultimately to be from my perspective. I don't think inflation is going to get carried away. I don't think it's going to go to some 1970s type level. Maybe down the road that could be, but right now I don't see that being the case. And then putting that back into the crypto world, you know, slightly higher interest rates in here for cryptos could be a little bit of a negative for cryptos. I mean, they certainly did very well in a very, very low interest rate environment. But I think what's going to ultimately make cryptos work in a low environment or a higher environment is ultimately going to be rules to the road getting established. This saber rattling between Gary Gensler and Coinbase at this point in time, I think is terrific. It's going to clear the path for the rules, the regulations. I do not believe, this is again my perspective, but I do not believe that they want to kill the cryptocurrency industry as some people are speculating. Because guess what? I'm paying taxes, and anybody else that is out there trading the cryptocurrencies or mining it are paying ordinary income or capital gains taxes on the trading that they're doing. And the U.S. government with $32, $33 trillion in debt shouldn't be cutting off any sort of potential revenue stream for them. So I think cryptos will work, and it will be a viable, I think, alternative in the future.
Excellent. And that higher yield, higher interest rates, do you see that impacting the longer dated growth equities? I mean, do you think we'll see a leadership change away from certainly non-profitable tech, but growth equities as a whole?
I think only if you saw interest rates to say move up to 6 or 7%, but that's not what I'm thinking at this point in time. I'm thinking that 10-year bond yields could get stuck in a range of 3 to 4%. And from that perspective, just stuck in a range of 3 to 4%, I think you can still see those long dated pieces, work okay.
Thank you, Craig. Awesome.
Greg, we've had you for about an hour now. So I know you're an extremely busy guy. I know you got a ton of calls today. So absolutely, on behalf of the CNT Association, myself and Tyler, want to say thank you very much for your time today. Of course, thank you very much for all of your service within the CNT Association. It's you've been a valuable asset of the organization, a big reason for why people join is so they can get to know Craig better. So thank you for that. Tyler, you have any wrap-up questions before we let the man go?
I will just say that one of the projects for the 50th anniversary CMT Symposium was to write a history of markets and of this wonderful organization since the late 1960s. And I was tasked with writing a little commentary about the future of the organization, but also about our global expansion. And Craig Johnson, I may have more pictures of you at conferences, seminars, events, chapter meetings, long-range planning. It's been a real pleasure to work with you since I first joined in 2011. And I believe at that time you were the secretary of the board, quickly moved to vice president, and then became the president at a time that was a real pivot point for technicians. Yeah. We reworked the CMT curriculum. You had an incredible supporting role, shouldering a lot of responsibilities through a big change process, as well as the change of the name of the organization from MTA to the CMT Association. And for all of our listeners, Craig Johnson is probably one of the most open, friendly, ready to mentor, happy to answer question kind of members of this organization. So thank you for being such a staunch advocate and an awesome mentor. It's been quite the run.
Well, Tyler, thank you for the kind words, but I got to tell you, so we're still on the board of the Technical Analysis Educational Foundation, and there's still more change to get done. And even though I'm not president or on the CMT board anymore, I still think we've got more things we'd like to get done to help the organization as a whole. So here you'll hear from me in the near future on some of these new topics and projects that I would love to get cleaned up and done.
Cannot wait. For all of our listeners, make sure to check the show notes. We'll have some links in there and a few charts to help guide this conversation. Craig, as always, pleasure to get your thoughts on the market. Great to see you. And hopefully Dave and I will get back to Minnesota one of these days soon so we can, have one of those grain belts that Minnesota is so famous for.
Happy to do it. Thanks, Tyler. Thanks, Dave. Appreciate it.
You got it, Craig. Thanks so much for your time, man.
Fill the Gap is brought to you with support from Optima. In addition to candidate study of the official CMT curriculum, Optima provides a full video course on all of the material that candidates need to know for each level of the CMT exams. Each course is broken up into modules ranging from 15 to 45 minutes, depending on the complexity and length of the topics being covered. Learn more at Optima.com.